Welcome to Passing Years CAM Podcast, Conversations on Air Digestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guest, Dr. Amy Freeman Sanderson, having a conversation on the psychological impact of communication.
I'd like to welcome everyone to the Conversations on Area Digestive Management podcast. I am here today with Dr. Amy Freeman Sanderson, coming to us all the way from Australia. Dr. Freeman Sanderson is a senior lecturer and speech pathologist in the Graduate School of Health at the University of Technology, Sydney, and an honorary clinical specialist speech-language pathologist with the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. She has over 19 years of clinical experience in the area of speech pathology, and she's going to be talking with us today a little bit about the importance of communication with patients, their rights to have access to communication, and their need to have their voice and be able to have autonomy and participate in their care. She's done a lot of research in this area, and so we're going to talk with her about her research and her findings, and in a general sense, kind of the importance of what the patients need. Welcome, Amy. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Is there anything I did not share about your background that you'd like to?
I'm an honorary of the critical care division of the George Institute for Global Health.
Because we have an international audience and you're joining us from Australia, do you mind sharing a little bit about what that is?
So in terms of the George Institute for Global Health, they're a research institute that look at all types of research across the globe, and particularly delivering socially responsible and equitable research. So they have a critical care division, and I'm an honorary fellow of that division, so contributing to research that has impact across the globe.
Wow, congratulations. That's really quite an accomplishment, but I'm sure it's linked to the fact that your research is focused on communication, critical care, working with patients in the ICU. Before we delve into that, though, can you share a little bit about what got you started in this area? Like, why did you start looking at communication with patients?
Sure. So it was during my time when I worked at St. Thomas's in London. So I traveled over there and was working in the ICU. And primarily a lot of the caseload tends to be focused on dysphagia. So I remember one day we had a referral for a patient that was on a ventilator, and he was in in the palliative care stage. And really there was an increased need from the patient and request to try and enhance communication, so particularly around being able to effectively engage him in conversations. So I remember going in to see him, reading his file, and I asked if we could do an inline speaking valve with him. It wasn't at the time a typical patient that would be necessarily considered, but the medical team gave consent. And we were able to establish effective voice for him. And I remember ringing his wife, and he spoke with her. And after he got off the phone, she said to me, you have no idea what that means to be able to have a verbal conversation and what they were able to say to each other. And that stayed with me. It almost, I guess, started a fire inside me. And I thought, why aren't we doing this for a lot more patients? And I started to explore. So that was in the early 2000s. And I started to explore what was around at the time. And there was obviously emerging evidence, but there wasn't a lot of evidence in terms of looking at how early intervention, how early restoration of voice could be used in this population. And I went up to the director. So I'd moved back to Australia, and I spoke to the director and in ICU, and he said to me, oh, where's the evidence? And I said, oh, we need to get more evidence. So he said, okay, get the evidence. And that spurred me on to enroll in a PhD, and I was supported within my ICU at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital to complete my PhD. So that was in early intervention for restoration of voice in mechanically ventilated patients. So that stayed with me, and it's, I guess, really the basis of a lot of my research now, looking at how do we really support patients and staff. It's a team. So how do we approach and enhance opportunities for communication within the ICU to really improve that experience and those exchanges?
I know that oftentimes patients complain that people speak over them and don't include them in the actual discussions or the care. And some of that happens because they don't have a voice. You know, they're not able to interject. Can you share a little bit about what some of the options are for communication in the ICU?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it's interesting what you've just said. So it's really, it's almost like a place at the table, right? When somebody has that, their normal communication abilities taken away or they're reduced, they don't always feel like they're offered a place at the table, or perhaps it's so difficult that they retract back. And certainly patients have said that to me, it's just so difficult. So each patient is unique, and I think we need to look at both sides of communication, their understanding and expression. So certainly for expression, we need to look at different modes. So we use multiple modes every day ourselves. So looking at verbal and nonverbal modes. So we know that people want naturalistic communication. So for most people, that's being able to use our voice. So where possible, it's looking at how can I safely and effectively restore this patient's voice. So certainly that's, I guess, my top option that I look for in terms of early cuff deflation. So in the case of tracheostomy patients, early cuff deflation, placement of a valve to get them utilizing their voice. I know we have a lot of other options available as well. So there's increased research in regards to above cuff vocalization. We have nonverbal methods in regards to, I guess, unaided and aided augmentative communication. So if we think about nonverbal communication, those two aspects, so looking at natural body gestures, pointing, looking at picture boards, writing, looking at using devices as well. So a lot of new technology has come in, and we use technology every day. So in regards to using our mobile phones and our tablets to use apps to be able to communicate messages as well. So there's many options, and I think we need to consider what where the patient's strengths are, and so how do we manage those? So looking at their physical strength, looking at their visual acuity, how supportive does that communication need to be? So even at the most basic level, having the call bell available, so the person, we use communication to gain attention, right? So in the ICU, where patients can be in a situation that even though staff are around, they need to gain attention. So having a source to say, hey, I need help, or to alert somebody to come over to start that communication process is really important.
Well, I agree. And you touched on a few, like you said, both verbal and nonverbal modes of communication. I want to stick to the verbal just for a moment. Can you share a little bit about how you determine whether you're going to use above the cuff vocalization, or whether you're going to use a speaking valve or leak speech, or what some of those verbal options are?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess really above cuff vocalization can only be utilized with a type of tracheostomy tube that has that above cuff port. So if the patient doesn't have that, then they're unable to use that particular mode. So I guess in terms of the assessment and looking at the suitability, my clinical preference is to look at deflate, if we can deflate the cuff to allow leak speech and speaking valve. So it's what we do is have a look at the patient's, their alertness. We look at their medical stability. So what's happening to them in terms of their central cardiac function, their respiratory function, and also their ventilation status. So we need to have everything aligning, so we know that we're optimizing safety and the effectiveness of communication. So I guess in a lot of my experience, we've looked at the amount or the fraction of oxygen that somebody's been on. So atmospheric pressure for oxygen is 21%. So when patients are on a ventilator, the higher the fraction of oxygen they need can be often be an indicator of how sick their lungs are. So particularly we've looked at patients or had more success of patients that have been on around 40% of fractionated inspired oxygen, but that can obviously be different for each centre. We look at the pressures that people are on as well. So when making a decision, it's always done in conjunction with the multidisciplinary team. So just taking it back to it's looking at all of these parameters, discussing them with the team, so the consultants, the nurses and physiotherapists, to make sure that, yes, this is a suitable candidate. So I know that's a long answer, but there's not a magic number, I suppose, is what my takeaway is there's not an exact black and white number to say you're appropriate, you're not. You have to take each person individually and look at their physical parameters and determine what the risks are. So the risks of not communicating are also very real. So it's managing that in the mix with the patient. So obviously in regards to cuff down, we're looking at the ability to manage that airflow via the larynx, so in terms of laryngeal function, and swallow safety comes into that. So making sure that the patient is able to effectively and appropriately manage their level of secretions. So there's always secretions above the cuff, so that's nothing new that we find. And it's not a surprise initially, because there's been that period where the patient may have been sedated, not alert. So we're expecting some sort of level of secretions above the cuff. So if they if they're cleared on cuff deflation and then the patient's able to manage their secretions during that period of cuff down, then that's a good indicator that they can manage the speaking valve for that period. And the period that they manage the cuff down, it can depend for each patient as well. So we don't need to necessarily start with a set amount. Some patients may only tolerate a short duration, and some might tolerate a longer duration as well. So again, there's that context to consider.
I think you made a really good point now I'm using a little bit different wording, but there's not a cookie cutter approach to our patients. We can't.
No, there's not.
There's no one answer or anything else. We have to, as you said, look at them as individuals and what their individual needs are. And I think that's really important. And I mentioned before I asked you that question kind of early, I mentioned the patient's right to have access to communication. And there are some legal ramifications, and it's a little different country to country, I know, but patients do have a right to have access to communication. But then you've done some research looking at the psychological effect of not having their voice and not being able to communicate. So can you share a little bit on that side of it as to, you know, not just we need to provide them the access, but the ramifications, the potential ramifications if they don't have access to communication?
Yeah, certainly happy to share that. And I think we're still learning to understand that, because I'll just start off by just framing it that with hospital admissions, every diagnosis that a patient has or every procedure is coded and it's coded by case mix, and we have these international classification of diseases and in terms of, I guess, these codes in regards to what patients had. And we have a diagnostic reference code for aphasia, for dysarthria, but there isn't actually one for poor communication because of an artificial airway. But yet we know this has a impact on the patient level, the healthcare providers, the time it takes to communicate as well. So understanding it from all angles is really important. So yeah, a lot of, I guess, my research has been, first of all, understanding from the patient side. So we need to consider the continuum of care for somebody in critical care. So it's quite obvious in the acute phase, that's what we're often focused on. So during the ICU, what's the impact? So in a couple of my studies, I had a look at what the impact was in regards to elements of self-esteem. So they included elements like happiness, looking at depression, and even identity. So in terms of, did they feel themselves or did they feel more confused? So patients certainly rated themselves as having more depression, lower levels of happy emotion, and more feeling trapped when they didn't have their voice and they weren't able to communicate and participate. Explore that a little bit more, because the numbers do give us information, but it doesn't provide that richness. It doesn't provide that patient experience. So when I delved a little bit further, patients reported it like a loss of self. So we use our voice to communicate in ICU our care needs, so our basic needs. So in terms of I need suctioning, I'm in pain, it's our comfort needs. So I'm really uncomfortable in bed. Can I just roll positions a little bit more? Or my eyes are really dry, I need eye drops. It's to convey, to have social connection. So social connection and communication is really the origin for social connection. So having that, establishing that rapport and relationship with people that are looking after you. And patients have reported to me that the importance of being able to convey gratitude to staff, to be able to say thank you to the nurses. And that's such an important part to what they want to convey and their gratitude for being looked after. So when they don't have a voice, it's not as easy for them, and they feel that they're not viewed as really being themselves. We've seen with the pandemic as well, sort of that reduced visitation, so needing to be able to communicate effectively with people outside my room. So people, patients have said they really need that effective communication with people outside. And when they haven't had it, it's really taking them to a place where they've increased more anxiety, where they've increased more negative emotions. And 6 months after some of these patients have been in hospital, I asked them then, sort of reflecting back on that, has it impacted you? And it was still persistent and ongoing impact from that time. So there was, even though they had resolved, their tracheostomy had been decannulated and had their voice back, they were still experiencing pain and anxiety and anger over that time when they weren't able to communicate. So it has longer lasting effects beyond being in ICU. So earlier restoration of voice really made people feel that they were getting better. It was almost like a change moment for people that, you know, yes, I'm getting better. And it increased motivation to participate in therapy and to really step forward with plans as well. So I think that's an important element that sometimes that we don't consider.
And to add to that, I know in 2016, there was a publication, a study done by Johns Hopkins that was put out that found that patients who could not communicate were three times more likely to experience an adverse event, either a mismedication or over-medication, and all the way through to more severe adverse events. I think there were even some cases of death because of the miscommunication. So there's even risk with that. And I don't know the particular study, but I know that there's been some publications that link that lack of communication to ICU delirium.
Yeah.
And it contributing to that.
So, I mean, with that, I guess in some of my newer research, we're looking at that overlay of communication and delirium. So delirium, management of agitation, orientation, they're all really important aspects of intensive care and to management. So even the assessment process in terms of establishing if a patient is orientated, it's quite difficult to answer the questions if you don't have an effective way to actually answer, and being able to orientate yourself to get that auditory feedback as well. That certainly is interesting, you know, an interesting aspect to see, you know, how does that facilitate people to move forward with orientation.
And I think it's really important when we're looking at our patients in the ICU is, as we said, accessing the communication. You mentioned that it motivates them more for therapies. You know, the research has shown sometimes that they have shorter lengths of stay in the ICU after getting their voice back and using their upper airway. They have potentially shorter time, they wean faster from the ventilator. So there's other benefits, not just from the communication side, but just in getting them participating in that care and actually accessing, as an example, accessing their voice or getting more involved in PT and physical therapy.
In regards to sedation practices and early mobilization, so we can look to our physiotherapy colleagues, and early mobilization is really sort of a large area of research, and trying to reduce that protracted muscle weakness to improve all of those physical outcomes. That's really important. And so if we think about pairing that with effective communication, if a patient can say, you know, add input into that during their rehabilitation session, that's going to make that session sort of much more engaging. They might be able to tailor exercise, as an example, get effective ideas around pain, or just to even explain elements of therapy. So I think there's this, you know, a big shift, and it's really starting to gain momentum. So we need to see how do we optimize that for the patient, and having effective communication is definitely one of the key drivers for that.
I agree. And I think you mentioned early on the patient needing a seat at the table. And I think that's really important to getting, I think it was the patient, but we also need a seat at the table. We need everybody at the table. And if the patient can be participating and more involved,
that's right.
Help their care.
I mean, the other aspect, I mean, that I wanted to flag that has been mentioned to me along the way, just with my research journey, is the importance of needing to convey degree of emotion. Okay, so with our voice, for example, and you know, I'm acutely aware that it's not always possible, but looking at sort of what do people need and what do they want. So being able to convey emotion. So for example, when somebody says no, the difference between saying no or no, like it really having that that feeling behind it, all that emotional drive, it makes a difference. So, or I'm in pain, or I'm in so much pain. We get more communicative information. There's more communicative context. The urgency to which I need to respond to that might be different. So if we can provide that, tap into that with communication, that provides such a better experience for patients as well.
That's such a key point, because we all know when we text and everything else, we can't convey tone.
Yeah, and we see you shouting.
Can't read it. And it's the same thing for a patient. If they're using a communication board or they're having to hand write things, they can't convey those super segmentals and that tone and emotion and all like you're talking about. And exactly. Yeah, that is another important aspect of having their voice. Now, one question I'd have for you, and this is kind of just general clinical practice, but in the United States, at least, we often hear of issues for speech pathologists getting involved in the ICU or in that early intervention, that they're not consulted until after the patient leaves ICU or until they're weaned from the ventilator. They're not, you know, involved in that earlier care. Do you have any advice or recommendations you'd make to help improve getting that access, that earlier intervention access?
Sure. I think, look, there are a couple of caveats to this, and it definitely comes down to teamwork and collaborative teams. So I think really highlighting our role, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, a bulk of what we do, certainly in acute, it is dysphagia. So I think a lot of and a lot of focus needs to go on to that, and certainly in regards to safety. But I think we could be have more of an advocacy role in terms of what we might offer in terms of the communication space, and looking at how does it help the rest of the team do their job effectively as well. So if we think about, for example, ward round, and the patients are needing to effectively convey, you know, what are my symptoms today, what are my concerns today, being able to effectively communicate that or participate in ward round improves the symptom management. It improves decision making, consultation. So that was one aspect that I've done before. So, for example, If I've wanted to highlight communication, I've done it around ward round time. So it's being able to engage the rest of the team to look at what the benefits are, how it's also helped the medical team and the nursing staff engage in care with that patient. So doing that, offering to do education is another aspect that I've done before. Doing joint research. So research, it doesn't have to be a whole PhD. So you don't need to be scared by research, but by doing something collaboratively with the team, it shows that you're engaged, and it then becomes joint ownership. You're able to get an ally. You're able to get people on your team, and a lot of problems are solved. They're more easily solved with more brains than one. So when you've got patients and you need to problem solve, having that supported team around you can actually be the first step if you're not doing this, to say, okay, we want to start this process. How do we do it? And how do we do it together? It gets people engaged. So certainly the tips that I've done before that have been beneficial, hang out on the ward round. Don't just, if you've got the opportunity, and I'm not saying everyone has all this time, but it's a strategic use of time, because you're part of that team. So going on ward round, just chipping in little bits of conversation to say, oh, look, that patient is awake. It looks like they're not effectively communicating. These are a couple of options. So starting those conversations, that's how to be a strategic innovator and to do that collaboratively as a team. So they're my top tips.
No, I appreciate them. You actually brought up two that I've not thought of that I really appreciated. One was when you talked about the patient's ability to participate in the ward rounds and being able to provide their symptoms and answer questions and how that's going to affect their care. Yeah. And that's not an argument I've used before. I've said that you could say patients need to be able to communicate, but actually linking it to their care and to the information doctors need and all is, that's a really good tip. And then also you mentioned research, and you're right. A lot of people will say they're either not sure how to get started, or they fear trying to do research a little. And I just want to tack onto that, because what I often tell people is it's very easy to incorporate research into what they're already doing. Well, I want to thank you. I appreciate you spending the time with us to talk about the importance of communication, getting a seat at the table, and even how to link in some research to working in the ICU as a way almost of buying yourself in the door, or getting yourself in the door of the ICU and linking in the research. So I appreciate all the key points that you shared and the recommendations that you have for people. I think that's going to be helpful.
Yeah, no problem. And I think it's, you know, we have skills, everyone has skills to contribute, and it's a different avenue and a different way to do it. And how do you do it with support to learn that as a team? So it's always a team approach.
Yes. And you mentioned mentors, and finding a good mentor can be beneficial.
Exactly. So mentors are key. I've got some wonderful mentors. It's reaching out to people. So don't be afraid to email people, to reach out, to be able to have a conversation. It's having mentors. It provides me with clarity, different views, different examples, ideas. So I'm so grateful for my mentors. And you can have a couple of different mentors as well. So really think about how you grow yourself as well, and really develop forward. So definitely seek out a mentor.
And I'm glad you just mentioned that you have mentors that you work with.
Yeah.
Because you've been practicing for quite a while. You've been doing research. You're well published. You speak both domestically and internationally, and yet you have mentors. And it just points out we're constantly learning. I think our field is one that's always changing, and we can always use a mentor, no matter how long we've been practicing or what area we work in, you know, having those colleagues and people to work with.
That's right. And I think it's, you know, what it was actually one of the deans at my dean of research at my university. She talked about this idea of excellence. So what is clinical excellence? You know, what clinical excellence was 5 years ago, isn't what it is today. And what is excellent today isn't what excellent is going to be in 5 years. It changes. So we need to be always changing. We need to adapt to change. You know, that being on that border of innovation, and you know, we've all got an opportunity to be in that innovation. So excellence is always going to change. So we need to contribute to that and to keep up with that as well.
Thank you so much. I think I'm going to stop there because that I think is the perfect point to end on. And I really appreciate your time with me.
No problem.
In this episode of CAM, Dr. King and Dr. Freeman Sanderson discuss conducting research. To hear more of this conversation and learn strategies for conducting research at your facility, catch the next episode of CAM, Starting Research in a Clinical Setting, launching Friday, May 27th.
Research, it doesn't have to be a whole PhD, so you don't need to be scared by research, but by doing something collaboratively with the team, it shows that you're engaged and it then becomes a joint ownership. You're able to get an ally. You're able to get people on your team.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA and the California Board of Nursing for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passymuir.com/podcast and click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed.